To mention as well that next week will be our final shiur of this series. Next week there will be a shiur, and then we'll take a 3-week break, as is our minhag. But in the meanwhile, this evening we conclude Chumash Bamidbar. We have both parshas of Matos and Maaseh. And I would like to dedicate most of our time actually to Parshas Matos. We'll see there are a couple of discussions. I cannot say that they will be light discussions, but I do hope that they will be illuminating nonetheless. The Parsha of Matos opens with a discussion of nidarim, of vows. Ish ki yidor neder, Lashem. And there is a whole institution in the Torah and a series of mitzvahs that surround nedarim, and indeed there is a whole body of halacha. There's a masechta of nedarim, which has quite a reputation actually from ancient days as being not the easiest. And as we know, the anti-step to making a neder is having a neder revoked. For nedarim, there is hataras nedarim. And the Mishnah, actually in Maseches Chagiga, not in nedarim, in Chagiga, in Daf Yud, the Mishnah has an interesting thing, an interesting characterization of hataras nedarim. And that is, says Mishnah, hete nedarim porchim ba'avir. Hataras nedarim, it floats in the air. And what that means is that it has, in a sense, minimal basis or minimal attachment to any given pasuk. It's in the air. It's airborne. But it is there. Now, that makes it sound as if there is no source for Hataras Nedarim, which there is. And the Gemara actually provides the source. And that is, if we look at the second pasuk, Ishki Yudah Neder Lashem, O Yishova Shavua, Leso Yisrael Nafsho, if he takes a neder or a shavua, and there's many differences between them, Lo Yachel Devaro. Now, Lo Yachel Devaro, probably the easiest translation of that phrase is he should not profane his words, from the expression Chulin. And how does he profane his words? By violating his vow. His vow says something is off limits, and to act in a profane way means to ignore that. That's lo yachel devaro. However, says the Gemara, lo yachel means he can't do that. He cannot achieve that effect. Hu eino mechel, aval acheirim mechilim lo. He cannot revoke the vow, but others can revoke the vow for him. Interestingly, this drasha appears twice, or more correctly, in two formats in Chazal. What we have just quoted is the Gemara in Chagiga, Hu eino meichel, aval acher mechelin lo. He cannot make them into a mundane thing. Others people can do so for him. In Maseches Brachos and Daf Lamed Beis, when this drasha is referenced, the expression is Hu eino mochel. Mochel from the expression mechila, he cannot forgive, meaning he can't forgo. Other people can be mochel for him. And it's interesting to ponder what is the difference between hu eino mochel, hu eino mechel. It's not just the same thing said with a Litvisha accent, as we will appreciate. But in any case, whatever it is that he can't do, others can do with him. Interestingly, if one may pause for a moment, I don't think it's a wrong question to ask. It's not that immediately apparent as to why this is called up in the air, as to why this drasha is called floating in the air. It seems to be a rather straightforward inference. He can't do it, other people can. If we may say, as drashas go, this doesn't seem to be that extreme or that complicated, to the extent that it's considered to be almost like a vague drasha. It seems to be rather straightforward as these things go. But so be it. In fact, it doesn't even seem to be a drasha in that sense, because it's seemingly an inference. In any case, he can't do that. Other people can achieve that effect for him. Which other people? Who can do that for him? So Rashi gives us the background. On the Dibur HaMaskil of Rashi Hamatos, which is the first Rashi, it's a relatively long Rashi, and it is a few lines in to the Rashi. Because the Parshas Nedarim starts being addressed to Roshei HaMatos. Roshei HaMatos are the leaders. It sounds like there's some special application or meaning of this part of the Torah for the leaders. What is that? So Rashi asks, Umara'a la'omra kan? Why does the Pasuk mention the leaders here? One could almost hear refrains of Ma'inin Shmita Etzel Har Sinai. Ma'inin Roshei HaMatos Etzel Nedarim. What is their special connection to Nedarim? Because Lama it teaches you Shafaris Nedarim biyochid mumcha, because it is these leaders, they are the ones who are entrusted and they are the ones who are authorized and licensed to revoke a neder. If they are what's called yochid mumcha, if they are expert in these things, if they're absolutely proficient, one person can do it, Roshei HaMatos. Now, if you don't have one person, in our own experience, and when do we experience Hataras Nedarim? In Kol Nidre, which according to the Gaonim is Hataras Nedarim, or more recently on Erev Rosh Hashanah, people do Hataras Nedarim, and I've never seen anyone stand in front of one person. I guess go find a mumcha nowadays. We always have in front of three people. What's called, if there's no expert in that way, Mefer B'Shloshed Yotos. You can take three ordinary people and be made for the neder in front of them. So where does that come from? Where did three ordinary people enter the equation? We only hear about Roshei HaMatos. So Rashi says, there's a Gezeira Shava. Now this is a drasha. Gezeira Shava, as we know, whenever two areas in the Torah share a same phrase or word, it serves to link those two, and the transfer of information, of halachas, from one to the other. So we have Zeh HaDavar in our Parsha, the famous Zeh HaDavar, and over there in Parshas Acharemos, in the section of Shchutei Chutz, which is about not offering a korban outside the Beis HaMikdash, which interestingly has associations with Nedarim, the Gemara says if a person makes a neder, it's like he built a bomber. But in any case, just over there, it's addressed to all of Bnei Yisrael. So too, the Nedarim is addressed to all of Bnei Yisrael, anyone amongst Bnei Yisrael. So why'd you mention the expert? Because if it's an expert, he can do it by himself. If it's ordinary people, as per the Gezeira Shava, you need three of them. Now, if we pause here for a moment, because we've already said quite a lot, but it's interesting to ponder that one almost gets the implication, one almost gets the idea that it's preferable to find an expert who's one person. Idiabed, if you didn't find an expert, so then go for three hedyotos. That's the way Rashi seems to be expressing it. If there's no mumcha, go for three hedyotos. We're familiar with the idea that one expert judge can take the form of three. There is such a concept in halacha. But that's normally considered to be a chiddush. That's normally considered to be b'di'eved. Lechatchila, you want to go for three. B'di'eved, one person can act in lieu of three. So it's interesting that almost the order of preference seems to have been reversed. In every other area of Torah, we prefer to have three as opposed to one, expert though he might be. Whereas in Hataras Nedarim, the preference is for one. If you can't find one, so there's always three hedyotos. That's a very interesting thing to observe. Now, if we keep on with this expert, this Yochid Mumcha, as he's called, what exactly is the nature of his expertise? Or more correctly, what is the degree to which he needs to be an expert? We know there is a concept that a judge comes into an altogether different level when he has what's called smicha, when he's a musmah. Now, smicha, lahavdil, Bein Kodesh LaKodesh, it is not what we call today smicha. Nowadays smicha means he knows halach as well, and he could be a rabbi. And good luck to him. But smicha, the original smicha, was an ordination that came from Hashem to Moshe, from Moshe to Yeshua, as the Pasuk says in last week's parasha, Vayismoches Yadav Alav, Vayibarcheu. And so it was an unbroken chain until it was broken. That means to say it was a continual chain until two or three generations into, three or four generations into the Gemara, and then it was always targeted by the authorities. They saw in the smicha really an anti-voice to what they were trying to do. And it was stamped out. And there are certain areas of halacha that one could only adjudicate if they have smicha, knowledgeable though they might be. So smicha, in that respect, is a very important qualification to have for a dayan. Does he need it in order to be Matir Neder by himself? Says Ramban, yes. In other words, if you want to know what exactly do we mean when we say Yochid Mumcha, an individual is an expert, it means someone who has that smicha, which means nowadays could never happen. We don't have that smicha anymore. The Rambam, interestingly, in Hilchos Nedarim, when he talks about him being an expert, makes no mention of smicha. He doesn't need to have smicha in that way. He just needs to know the halachas of Nedarim extremely well. So we have a rather unusual machlokas here as to when we're looking for our expert who can single-handedly revoke people's Nedarim, does he need to be proficient or qualified to the extent that he has smicha or no? According to the Ramban, yes. According to Rambam, no. And our question is, what are they arguing about? And the one, of course, that we would be most interested in is Rambam. Because where did smicha go? Well, that's always a qualification that an individual judge needs. At the very least, he needs smicha. How come he doesn't need it here? So a very wonderful, which will really, I believe, open up the entire discussion of Hataras Nedarim. I'm not sure that we always get a chance to ponder it at length. When we do Kol Nidre, although sometimes the rate the Chazan goes, there's plenty of time to think about it, but I don't think that's what's on our minds, and maybe rightly so. But Rabbi Tzala Zolti, chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, in his Sefer Mishnas Yavetz, has a fascinating analysis, and as is often the case, he lights up the sugya. The first thing we need to know about Hataras Nedarim, we say, go to a Beis Din, get a Beis Din, get a Hatara. Revoking a vow and the process of revoking a vow is not pure din at all. It is not the typical thing that the Beis Din do at all. And moreover, from other vantage points, we know that the qualifications for the Beis Din are not the same for Hataras Nedarim as you need for a normal din, nor are conditions. And these are important halakhas. For example, when it comes to Hataras Nedarim, the members of the Beis Din are allowed to be related to each other. And that could never happen in a normal din. There are very strict halakhas about that. But it's mutter. Moreover, it's possible to do Hataras Nedarim at night, which many congregations do. When they say Kol Nidre, although ideally Kol Nidre should be done before the night, but that's not because you can't do Matir Hataras Nedarim at night. It's because you don't normally Matir Neder on Yom Tov. It's not about day versus night. It's about Yom Kippur versus Erev Yom Kippur. That's the irony of Kol Nidre. The more you understand what Kol Nidre is, the less you see that it can actually shouldn't really even be part of Yom Kippur proper itself. In any case, but all things being equal, it is absolutely acceptable to do Hataras Nedarim at night. And moreover, the judges can be standing. And isn't that also what happens with Kol Nidre? There's got to be a Beis Din somewhere who's doing Hataras Nedarim. They say it's the three who stand at the bima, or maybe it's the entire congregation functions simultaneously as the Beis Din. There's the Beis Din there somewhere, but everyone's standing. Isn't it true? Isn't it extremely important, the process of din, that whoever petitions the Dayanim, he stands and they sit? So you should have the people at the bima should be sitting down, which has never been suggested at all. You don't need it. Because Hataras Nedarim doesn't require that the Dayanim be seated. Those are in terms of what you could call the trappings of Hataras Nedarim, the details and finer points. But of course, when you think about it, Hataras Nedarim itself isn't the sort of thing that is like any other legal case. When you think about the cases that are brought before a Beis Din, there are cases that where there are claims and counterclaims, and they need to adjudicate, and they need to decide, and paskin, and judge. There isn't really that much judging that goes on with regards to Hataras Nedarim. They hear the person, assuming that he's not speaking in the air, nonsense, they give him a Hatara. No one's adjudicating. There isn't even a counter plaintiff or claimant. It's just him. He's petitioning for a Hatara, and if all goes well, he gets it. So even the very nature of Hataras Nedarim doesn't really sound like it's a it's a din sort of thing. But it does need a Beis Din. And that is true, by the way, that there are times when the Beis Din acts more in a representative capacity or presidential capacity and not so much in an adjudicating capacity. There's certain things that you need the Beis Din there for. Not to judge. You need a Beis Din to appoint a king. Not to judge, just to be there. A Beis Din needs to oversee Egla Rufa. They're not judging anything. They're just overseeing it. So there is such a thing. But Ataras Nedarim is certainly not judgment in that way. So now the question is, if it's not pure adjudication, do you need a Beis Din? And the answer, according to Ramban, is yes, it's one of those things that you need a Beis Din for, even though it's not din. And according to Rambam, no. You do not need a Beis Din. Which means the chiddush of the Rambam is that whether it's the individual who's an expert, or whether it's the three individuals who are just good, well-meaning individuals, they do not actually function as a Beis Din. That's really the thread that's running through all of these halachas. That's why they can be related to each other. That's why they don't need to be seated. That's why it can happen at night. I mean, all of these things, there's enough symptoms whereby at a certain point you realize these are not just exceptions to the rule, it's a different rule. I mean, this is just something else entirely. Not only is it not din, they are not a Beis Din. You can call them whatever you want, but they're not a Beis Din in the pure sense of the word. The question is, if they're not a Beis Din, then what are they? And now how does Hataras Nedarim work? He's basically coming towards to three people who have no jurisdiction and no authority invested in them as a Beis Din. They're just three people. And somehow they could be Matir as Neder. When three people get together, they can't really do that sort of thing in almost any other realm. So how does Hataras Nedarim work if they're not a Beis Din? It was easier to understand when they were a Beis Din, with all the exceptions. But if you say they're not even a Beis Din, so what are they? Says Ubshlom Zaman Orbach. That's all. To understand the Rambam's position, let us come back to the words Lo Yachel. And Lo Yachel is an expression of chulin, or maybe even chilul. In other words, to profane something. Lo yachel devaro. That means if a person takes a neder, he cannot degrade it. He cannot profane it. What constitutes degrading a neder? What constitutes profaning a neder? Says the Shlomo Zalman, the sort of thing that qualifies as degrading a neder is if he made a neder and then he just goes ahead and does it anyway. I mean, that is a degradation. It means he's not taking it seriously. That's a chilul. So what does he require? All that we require is that he demonstrate that he is taking it seriously. All that we require, it's a fascinating new, really, vista on all of Hataras Nedarim. It's not that it's also he makes it mutter. He made a neder, what's wrong for him is to degrade it by violating it in a flippant way, as if to say, he made a neder, he doesn't care. He's going to do it anyway. What does he demonstrate by going either to an expert single person or three well-meaning people and putting his case to them and saying how he regrets it? He does one thing. He shows that he has taken it seriously. That means he has not flippantly just or with no thought whatsoever just violating in this blasé way the neder that he made. In other words, that's really the goal of what Hataras Nedarim is, to show that he understands it's a serious thing and he regrets it. Once he's done that, he's not considered to have been mechalel his neder, even if he then does what he said he wouldn't do. But he didn't do it lightly. He took it seriously. He had to get people together and talk to them about it and shows that he regrets it, etc. All that we need for his clean bill of Hataras Nedarim is this person took the neder that he made seriously. Once he does that, so then he's clear. And what's interesting is, we can read just briefly from the Rambam himself, whose position we're looking to explain. In Hilchos Shavuos, Perek Vav Halacha Beis, he talks about Hataras Nedarim. V'davar zeh ein lo ikur klal b'Torah Shebichtav. This is not to be found in Torah Shebichtav at all. Okay, which is really the Mishnah. It's up in the air. Porkim ba'avir. Elakach lomdu mi Moshe Rabbeinu. This was learned from Moshe, mi Pi HaKabbalah, through tradition. that when it says lo yachel debaro, shelo yichalel hu ba'atmo, derech kalus rosh, we hear these expressions, he shouldn't just, again, flippantly, lightheadedly, b'shad nefesh, as if he doesn't care. Like it says, v'chilalta Hashem Elokecha. It's the degradation that we're looking to avoid. But if he regrets it, im nichem v'chazabo, chacha matir lo. How can a chacha make it mutter? Most things that are asr, you can't make mutter, even if you're smart. But here, the point is, when he comes, he's found a chacha who knows nedarim well, and he says, I made a neder and I regret it. That means he's, why is he clear? With the approval of the chacha. Because he sought out the chacha. And that shows that he's taking it seriously. He's no longer in violation of lo yachel, which is v'chilalta. That is the explanation of Rambam. And that's why when we think about these three people, what are they? What is their prime qualification? They're other people. They're people who are not him. That's all we need them to be. And they can be related to each other. It doesn't matter. But it shows that he is mindful of the fact he took a neder and isn't just in a cavalier manner violating it. And moreover, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, in conclusion, perhaps this may explain to us why in the case of Ataras Nedarim, the expert is preferable to the three people. Unlike every other case of din. In every other case, you go for the three. And it's a chiddush that one can assume the role of three. Here, lechatchila, you're going for the one. You're going for the yochid mumcha. Because we're not seeking out a bez din. If you're seeking out a bez din, three is the bez din lechatchila. We're not seeking out a bez din. We're seeking out some setting which demonstrates that he takes the fact that he took a neder seriously. If you find an expert, so with his expertise, that says more than three well-meaning individuals, and that's why the three here are pretty evident. So this, again, not the lightest of discussions, but it opens up not only two different pathways within Ataras Nedarim. For Ramban, it is yet a much more straightforward matter of din with Beis Din and everything that goes with it. For the Rambam, something else entirely, with all of the attendant details falling into place. So that's a few words with regards to Hataras Nedar. From here, we move to the parsha of Bnei Gad uBnei Reuven, which occupies the second half, or the third of Parshas Matos. And that really is the entirety of Perek Lamed Beis. So let us turn to Lamed Beis. Umiknerav, that's how it begins. They have a lot of cattle, Bnei Gad, Bnei Reuven, and they approach Moshe and they request to settle on the east side of the Yarden. Okay, Jews, as we've noted in the past, since that time, had more taken to the west side, but this group of people preferred the east side. Okay. Now, they submit to Moshe. Could we stay on the east side of the Yarden, Moshe? And Moshe, he responds quite harshly to them, and he castigates them, and says, "How can it be? They'll go to war. You'll stay here, and etc. etc. and so forth." But there is what we could refer to as an elephant in the room, really, in this whole discussion, and that is, no one seems to be mentioning the fact that there's a mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael, which you only fulfill if you live in Eretz Yisrael, and if you stay on the wrong side, if you stay outside, you're not fulfilling that mitzvah. That seems to go, it doesn't even get mentioned. The only question is, they'll go to the war, you go to the war, you'll dishearten them, you'll discourage them. What about keeping the halachas? To approach Moshe Rabbeinu with a request that you get a pass, you and your tribe, for fulfilling one of the most important mitzvahs in the Torah, I mean, that takes some doing. And Moshe doesn't even respond and mention it at all. Now, there's many responses to this question, there's many approaches to this issue, but quite a surprising one is to be found in the writings of Ramban. And Ramban says, if you wish to know why Moshe did not respond by saying, how can you presume or make so bold as to neglect fulfilling the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, the reason is because had they stayed where they were, they would not be in neglect of fulfilling that mitzvah. Because where they were was already a fulfillment of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Now, that takes some explaining, given the fact that they hadn't crossed over the Yarden yet. Why do I say this? Says Ramban. Well, let's see where they are. I mean, whose land have they conquered? They've conquered the land of Sichon and of Og. Sichon and Og belong to the Emori, their brothers. Sichon is called Sichon Melech HaEmori. Okay. If you go back to when the land and its tribes, territories, were first promised to Avram, in detail, which is in the Brit Ben Abisorim, which is in Parshas Lech Lecha, Rashi's Perek Tes Vav. So he is actually referred to, there are 10 territories that are mentioned to him. Now we know of the 10, 3 of them are for later on. They are the Keni, Knezi, and Kadmoni. We don't hear much from them until further notice. The Keni, Knezi, and Kadmoni, they are the land, says Rashi, of Moab and of Ammon, and it'll be a while before they're part of the greater Eretz Yisrael. Okay, so those three are out. But then, who else do we have? More familiar names. Chiti, Prizi, okay, and Rephaim. One of the 7 territories, which we call the Shivas Amamim, is the land of the Rephaim. Who are the Rephaim? Says Rashi, that's the land of Og. Eretz Rephaim is the territory of Og. Why do I say that? Shenema, because the Pasuk says it. In Sefer Devarim, in Chumash Devarim, in next week's Parsha, Hahu Yikare Eretz Rephaim, talking about Og's territory. Eretz Og, Shenema, Hahu Yikare Eretz Rephaim. So Rashi is absolutely on board with the Ramban here in terms of identifying the territory of Og, which is where these tribes are settled. By the way, Sichon is Emori. Emori is also one of the 7, as one of the Shivas Amamim, which means that those 7 tribes and those 7 territories extend also on the east side of the Yarden. This is part of the what's called Eretz Hamuftachas, the Promised Land. Says Ramban, and moreover, this may explain to us one or two things. If you notice, a little bit deeper, or actually we passed it already, but in Parshas Matos, when they go to war this week with Midian, so there are must be 2 dozen psukim describing the spoils of war and how they were apportioned. I mean, you can't miss it. And a certain amount was given to the Levi, and a certain amount was given to the Kohen, and so on and so forth. Machatzitzo kacha, machatzitzo kacha, a whole thing. Okay, so the moral of the story is when the Jewish people go to war, and there's spoils or whatever, so the Levi gets some of it. That's the moral of the story. Says Ramban, I just have one problem, and that is, this is not the first war that they have waged recently. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, did they not conquer the land of Sichon and Og? Were there not spoils there? Parshas Chukas, it's full of wars. The conquering territory, very rapidly. So it's a simple shaila. If the rule is that whenever the spoils Levi gets, how come we never heard of this before now? So Ramban says the answer is as per the above. Namely, Levi is told that they are not to inherit anything of Eretz Yisrael. The Pasuk says in Parshas Korach, V'chelek lo yiyeh lecha b'socham. You will have no portion b'socham in their midst. And the Sifrei has a drosha there. B'socham means afilu bebiza. Even the spoils of war that are involved in the conquest of Eretz Canaan, even those spoils, you have no chelek in those spoils. Oh, says Ramban, so now I understand. All the wars that we reference, which are a couple of weeks ago, conquering Sichon and conquering Og, of course there's no reference to Levi getting any of the chelek of the spoils there. That was part of the conquest of Eretz Canaan. Because that's Eretz Rephaim, that's Eretz HaEmori. And Levi doesn't get any of that. Which means our parsha is the first war, which was not really part of conquering Eretz Yisrael. It was a war of vengeance, really. Mekom nikmas Hashem, me'achar me'yasem idyonim. And therefore, this was the first war where the Nevi'im could also receive spoils, because all the prior wars have been conquest of Eretz Yisrael. In fact, this may explain, moving forward a few hundred years, but still basing ourselves on this position of Ramban, this may explain also a very well-known statement in the Gemara, in Masechet Sota and Daf Yudalet Amud Aleph, Rav Samloi. Darash Rav Samloi. Rav Samloi asked a very interesting shaila. Mipnei manis ava Moshe likanis l'eretz Kanaan. Why was Moshe so desirous of entering Eretz Kanaan? V'chilech ol mipiria, utzare ol esper mituva, what, just eat the fruits? Or to enjoy the bounty? And again, if we pause for a moment, that doesn't sound like such a bad thing. We daven for that in Alamichya, although it's a bit of a shaila. Some objected to it for this reason. In Alamichya, we say v'neirish ba'aleinu sechav v'sevchein v'vinyana v'nochal mipiria v'nisba metuva. We say that as something that we aspire to. Some people objected to it based on this Gemara, but the Beis Yosef defends it. It's a fantastic thing. Okay, but clearly the Gemara is saying, but that's not enough. I mean, that can't be the entire reason. It can't just, quote-unquote, be Le'chol mipiria v'nisba metuva. Ela Amar Moshe. Rather, says the Gemara, rather, says Rav Samloi, Moshe said, Harba mitzvahs nitzdavi Yisrael. The Jewish people were commanded with many mitzvahs. Ve'enu miskaimim ela sham, and they can only be fulfilled there, meaning in Eretz Kanaan. And therefore, says Moshe, Ikones, let me enter the land, v'yiskaimu ayodi, let them be fulfilled through me. And there are mitzvahs, of course, that can only be fulfilled in Eretz Kanaan, right? That's you can only build the Beis HaMikdash there, etc. and so forth. Plenty of mitzvahs. Now, what's the shaila which many raise throughout the generations? It's hard to understand Rav Samloi's question. Ask any child Rav Samloi's question. He'll answer you straight away. If you say to him, why do you think Moshe wanted to enter Eretz Canaan? If he knows anything, he'll tell you, because it's a mitzvah to live in the land of Israel. And once again, it seems to be this whole big idea, and we're walking around it the whole time. That's the answer. He wants to live there because it's a mitzvah to live there. Moshe loves mitzvahs, and that's that. One doesn't need to get to, you know, there's many mitzvahs you can only perform if you're there. That's a means towards an end. Living in Eretz Yisrael is its own mitzvah. So how come Rabbi Samoy didn't say that? And it's especially interesting according to Ramban, because Ramban codifies the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael as one of the 613 mitzvahs. He contests the Ramban on this point. Says the Meshech Chochma in Parshas Re'eh, according to the Ramban here, we can understand why Rav Samloi did not say the reason why Moshe wants to enter Eretz Canaan is in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. He is already fulfilling the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael because he is already in one of the seven territories of the Promised Land. It's not the west side of the Yarden, it's the east side, but it's still part of Eretz Yisrael in the full sense of the word. Now, there are a couple of issues which the Ramban himself raises. So far, on the one hand, it seems to be on a very solid basis, Eretz Rephaim, etc. and so forth. However, the two primary issues, one is from a Mishnah, and one is from the Chumash itself. The Mishnah in Maseches Bikurim, Al Rishon Rishon, first point, from the Mishnah. The Mishnah in Maseches Bikurim raises the question as to whether you can bring Bikurim, or whether there's a mitzvah to bring Bikurim, if you live on the east side of the Yarden. Reuven and Gad and all of those, their fruits begin to ripen. Is there a mitzvah of Bikurim? So interestingly, it's a machlokas. The first opinion in the Mishnah says yes, absolutely, which by the way is support for Ramban's position that it's already Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yossi Aglili says no. Rabbi Yossi Aglili says you don't bring Bikurim from Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because says Rabbi Yosef Glili, when you bring bikurim, so you say, I've just brought the fruits from the land asher nosatoli, that you gave me. Says Rabbi Yosef Glili, those two territories, Hashem didn't give them to us. We took them. Velo shenot lume atzmam. You can't talk about those territories as places that Hashem gave to you, because he didn't give them to you. You took them. Wow. So that, of course, seems to be in direct conflict with what the Ramban says, because the Ramban said these were parts of the promised land. If they're parts of the promised land, Hashem gave them to you. He didn't take them. So what is Rabbi Yosef Glili saying? That's the first question. The second question is from the Pasuk. Moving back to Parshas Chukas, in the end, you know, we conquered Sichon's land, but only because he attacked us. Our first communication with Sichon was to ask for permission to go through his land, because we just want to get to, we just want to go through it. As they say in the classics, just visiting. We're just going through. Now, Sichon wasn't happy with that. He went out to war. Oh, once he comes out to war, so we went out to war back and defeated him and took over his country. But that's b'dieved, so to speak. In other words, that's a contingency reaction. Our ideal policy was just to pass through his land. But the question is, if his land is part of the promised land, and there's a mitzvah to conquer the promised land, so why did we not ab initio make overtures towards conquering his land? Why did we actually try and go through it peacefully and only conquer it when he tried to conquer us first? These are serious questions. Well, the key here is to be found in one of the later Rishonim, the Tashbetz, Rabbi Shimon ben Semach, Duran. And the Tashbetz says that to understand the situation here, pardon the expression, the lie of the land, there are two aspects to the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. And they have different maps. One of them he calls Kedushas HaMitzvos, the land which has Kedusha that generates the famous mitzvahs, Hatluyos Baretz. And then there's a second type of Kedusha which is called Kedushas HaShechinah, Kedusha of the Divine Presence. And the map of these two places, as we said, is not the same. With regards to Kedushas HaMitzvos, which is the broader map, that extends to all seven nations. It's a chiddush, really, what the Tashbetz is saying. That extends to all seven nations, even those on the east side of the Yarden, they also have Kedushas HaMitzvos. As we know that they do, we know that the laws of Shemitah apply to Eivah HaYarden, and we know that the Trumas HaMaisos apply to Eivah HaYarden, and we know that those are absolute chiyuvim, and moreover, says the Tashbetz, the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael follows which map? The Kedushas HaMitzvos. In other words, wherever there's a mitzvah at Luyas Baretz, there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. You know how I know that, says the Tashbetz? The place in the Gemara where living in Eretz Yisrael is discussed most at length are the sukkahs at the end of Ksubas, the end of Masechus Ksubas. It's the famous sukkah of Hakol Ma'alim. Most people don't really focus on the inception of this sukkah. But a kol ma'alim basically means that any couple who are living in Chutz La'aretz, if either one of the spouses chooses at any time that they wish to move to Eretz Yisrael, they can force their spouse to move to Eretz Yisrael. That's how it all begins. It's a very halachic thing, which of course then generates all the wonderful discussions about the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. And that means that if they're living in Chutz La'aretz and the husband decides he wants to live in Eretz Yisrael, he can force his wife to accompany him. If she decides she wants to live in Eretz Yisrael, she can force her husband to accompany her. Okay, so be it. Now the halacha states that even if he only wishes to move to Eivah HaYarden, to the east side of the Yarden, which nowadays probably would not be that advisable, but back in the day, and also forward in the day, Mitz Hashem, if we want to move to Eivah HaYarden, they can also force one another, which is very interesting, because the power, or what it, more correctly, what empowers or entitles them to force one another, is the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. If you said that they can force even to move from Chutz La'aretz to Eivah HaYarden, that means that Eivah HaYarden already has the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. But all, so to speak, it has is Kedushas HaMitzvahs. yes, the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael follows Kedushas HaMitzvahs. If a place has Kedushas HaMitzvahs, there's a mitzvah to live there. That is Yishuv of Eretz Yisrael. But there is also what's called Kedushas HaShchina, which is only on the west side. But how does that manifest itself? And what does that mean, practically? I mean, the mitzvahs are the same. So what do you mean by calling the west side Kedushas HaShchina? Does that have halachic or practical ramifications? Says the Tashbetz. It does. Because the Medrash tells us in Bamidbar Rabbah, for example, you could only build the Beis HaMikdash on the east side, on the west side of the Yarden. You could only have the Mishkan, even before the Beis HaMikdash, where the Mishkan, which is also the center, it's got to be on the west side. You cannot say, well, east side, west side, it's all Eretz Yisrael, and therefore the Mishkan could be anywhere. No, it can't be anywhere. It specifically has to be on the west side, because the Mishkan is where the Shechina is, and Kedushas HaShechina of Eretz Yisrael is specifically on the west side. So it's mamish like a territory within a territory. On the one hand, the broader Eretz Yisrael, before we even get to the ten territories, even within the seven, broader Eretz Yisrael is Kedushas HaMitzvahs, which spills over even onto the east side. And Kedushas HaShechina specifically on the west side. And the truth of the matter is, this distinction between the two levels of Kedusha, or the two dynamics of Kedusha, is already recognized by Ramban. And with that, he answers these questions that were raised on him. We'll review them and deal with them. Firstly, or what is the key? Says Ramban, as true as it is that already the territories of Sichon and Og, they are part of the seven territories of the Promised Land. Yes. However, Moshe knew, even at that stage, that they were not in the interim going to conquer the entirety of Eretz Yisrael. Which, by the way, they didn't, even on the west side. And therefore, given the reality, whatever the factors that contribute to that, given the reality that they were not going to conquer all of Eretz Yisrael, that is why Moshe, in a sense, prioritized moving to the west. In other words, he did not, of his own volition, part anyone on the east side. Moreover, he didn't even make any attempts to conquer any of the east side. You've got the land of Sichon. It's right in front of you. It's one of the seven territories. And Moshe prefers to move through it. He does not wish to waste, so to speak, resources in conquering it and settling it, because if you're going to choose, because you're not conquering everything at the moment, you choose the west side. Why? Because it has Kedushas HaShechina as well. That is for sure your place of choice. And that is why he just wishes to pass through Sichon. And even when he is forced, so to speak, to conquer the land of Sichon, because Sichon attacked him, he conquers the land, he still doesn't look to settle it. He still just wants to make his way through it. The fact remains, however, when Reuven and Gad would like to stay there, you can't indict them for being neglectful of the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. They are in fulfillment of that mitzvah, but that's certainly not what Moshe prefers. And that is why he did not try and conquer Sichon, and that is also why we will ultimately look upon those territories as places where Hashem didn't give it to us, but rather they took it, because the choice was to move to the west side, and they chose the east side. So this is a very, very thought-provoking, again, it's not a light discussion, very thought-provoking position of Ramban. Many important questions are raised. We should note, just as a point of counter-voice, that not all agree with Ramban. In fact, not all Rishonim agree with Ramban. They would need to reckon with his proofs, which of course they are capable of doing. But classic among them is the Radak. And Radak, in his Perush Tehillim, understands that these territories of Eva HaYarden, they were not, shall we say, originally part of Eretz Canaan, but they assumed the status of Eretz Canaan through the fact that they were settled and annexed and attached to Eretz Canaan. They became part of Eretz Canaan, but they were not really part of the original Eretz Canaan. And he says this in explanation of the chapter of Tehillim, which we say on Shabbos morning, the Kila Olam Chastos, the 26 Kila Olam Chastos, where he compares two Prakim of Tehillim, in fact, when you think about it, and they're back-to-back in Pesukei Dezimra. Number 135, Kuf Lamed Hei, says, L'makim melachim gedolim, l'yog melachim adirim, l'sichon melach ha'mori, u'l'og melach ha'boshon, u'l'chol mam lachos kanan. So we mention Sichon, Og, and then all malchus kanan. In the next chapter of Tehillim, we mention only Sichon and Og. We don't, right? L'sichon melech ha'mori, kilo l'mchasto. L'og melech ha'boshan, kilo l'mchasto. And that's it. There is no kol mam l'chos kana. What's the difference between them? Says the Radak, the difference between them is that Mizmor Kuf Lamed Vav, all those Kilalim Chastos, they're Chesed. And Chesed means above and beyond. Beyond that which was promised. Eretz Yisrael, once it's promised, it's no longer Chesed. It's Emes in the sense that it needs to be fulfilled because Hashem has to fulfill His word. That's why the Pasuk says, Titin Emes Li Yaakov, Chesed Lavram. It was a Chesed Avram because Hashem didn't have to promise it to him. That was a kindness to promise it to him. But once he did, it's Emes Li Yaakov. I mean, that's truth now. You've got to live up to your word, so to speak. And therefore, the first chapter is dealing with all the good things that Hashem did for us. So we mention everything good. Sichon, Og, Canaan, it's all good. But as we move to the next chapter, which is Chesed, Canaan is not Chesed, because we were promised the land of Canaan, but we were not promised the land of Sichon and Og, says Radak. But we got it anyway. But that's why they have special mention, not only as good things, but as kindnesses, Kila Olam Chasto, Sichon and Og. And in fact, Reb David Tevel, the famous Talmud of Reb Chaim of Volozhin, in his drashas, based David, the final point, but it's a very elegant point, explains that there's a nuanced change here. See how the Gedolim learn Nevi'im and Ksuvim. In the first chapter, when it says Sichon, Og, and everyone, it says Venosan Artsan Nachala. Nachala Yisalama. In the second chapter, Sichon, Og, Kilon Chasto, Venosan Artsan Le Nachala. What is the difference between saying Nosan Artsan Nachala and Nosan Artsan Le Nachala? Nachala is inheritance. Le Nachala means to be an inheritance. And that's the difference between them. The land of Canaan, it was an inheritance. Sichon and Og were not. But they became an inheritance. And that's why, with regards to them, it says, Le Nachala. So, plenty more to say on all of these topics, but I think we've been Yotze this for this evening. We'll leave it over there for now.